to investigate any Trump corruption or other criminal acts whilst Donald Trump was in office. Kamala Harris also took a stance that may come to haunt the new administration. The vice president-elect, asked by NPR last year whether she would want to see charges brought by the Department of Justice, replied, "I believe that they would have no choice and that they should, yes." There are several possible ways in which the Justice Department could be forced to confront the issue of whether or not to take on Donald Trump. One would be through a revelation, as yet unknown, following the emergence of new information. Andrew Weissman points out that the Biden administration will have access to a wealth of documents that were previously withheld from Congress during the impeachment inquiry, including intelligence agency and State Department files. Official communications sent by Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump through their personal emails and messaging apps, an ironic move given the flack Hillary Clinton endured from the Trump family in 2016 for using her personal email server, may also become available for scrutiny. But the two most likely avenues for the pursuit of any criminal investigation would relate to Donald Trump's use of his presidential pardon power and alleged obstruction of justice. Trump issued a series of pardons largely characterized by political self-interest, Andrew Weissman said. Though the presidential pardon power is extensive, it is not, as Donald Trump has claimed, absolute, including the absolute right to pardon himself. He's not immune from bribery charges if he were found to have offered somebody a pardon in exchange for their silence in a judicial case. For Andrew Weissman, the way Trump continually teased his associates, including Roger Stone and Paul Manafort, with a promise of pardons in the middle of a federal prosecution was especially egregious. There may be a legitimate reason to give somebody a pardon, but what's the legitimate reason for dangling a pardon other than to thwart that person from cooperating with the government? Perhaps the most solid evidence of criminal wrongdoing compiled against Donald Trump concerns obstruction of justice. John Bolton, the former National Security Advisor, went so far as to say that for Donald Trump, obstruction of justice to further his own political interests was a way of life. In his final report on the Russia investigation, Robert Mueller laid out 10 examples of Trump's behavior that could be legally construed as obstruction of justice. Though Mueller declined to say whether they met the standard for charges, the U.S. Attorney General Bill Barr suggested they did not, but gave no explanation for his thinking. He did leave them in plain sight for any future federal prosecutor to revisit. In one of the starkest of those incidents, Donald Trump tried to scupper the special counsel inquiry itself by ordering his White House counsel, Don McGahn, to fire Robert Mueller. When that became public, he compounded the abuse by ordering Don McGahn to deny the truth in an attempt to cover up. Andrew Weissman, who played a key role in gathering the evidence against Donald Trump in the Robert Mueller investigation, said that such obstruction thus goes to the very heart of why Donald Trump should face prosecution. When the president, no matter who it is, obstructs a special counsel investigation, there have to be consequences. If you can obstruct an investigation criminally, but you don't have to worry about ever being prosecuted, well then, there is no point in ever appointing a special counsel.
Aperture. Agent Orange, a chemical cocktail that became notorious as a defoliant, was used in aerial bombardments against the Viet Cong in the Vietnam War. The U.S. military sprayed millions of gallons of Agent Orange onto Vietnam's jungles during the conflict to expose northern communist troops. 40 years since the end of the war, people in Vietnam with severe mental and physical disabilities still feel the lingering effects of Agent Orange. Its legacy of death and deformity is well documented. Cancer and birth defects amongst both Vietnamese and U.S. veterans have been linked to exposure to the defoliant. But what is less known is how Agent Orange was used after the war. I'm Zarin Shajari, and this is Aperture. Agent Orange is made up of the chemicals 245T and 24D. In the 1960s and 70s in Australia, the solution used in weed eradication often involved the spraying of herbicides 245T and 24D with terrifying consequences. Sprayers were often exposed to the deadly poison without any protective gear. Many sprayers died young, one after another. But still, this is not the full extent of the problems caused by the chemicals. Stay with us as we meet the families of former government employees who have died almost certainly as a result of their exposure.
Old Nigel Sinclair is in the last stage of terminal cancer. Nigel and his family believe he's soon to be the latest legacy from a chemical exposure which they say has killed his father, his uncle, and many of their mates. Before Nigel dies, he wants to know how a tragedy like this could happen.
At this very late stage, what would be the very best outcome for you?
It was like answers, really, just so my nana can rest and I can rest and me and my family can rest and put it to rest.
I'm lucky that he's still with us and still going. He has his moment where he'd like to have his closure.
Back in the 1970s and 1980s, hundreds of men were employed by the various state governments around the country to spray noxious weeds. Today, many are sick and many are dead.
A lot of the boys end up being the same, fading away near enough to nothing. Doctors turn and just, feed your medication, kill the pain. You're right, you'll be right. Next thing you know, they're dead.
Nigel's father was one of about 320 men in the West Australian Kimberley who sprayed herbicides for the state's Agriculture Protection Board, or APB. Now, there are reports of the sprayer's partners and children getting sick.
I think that they should have a close look, epidemiologically and clinically, at the children of those APB workers. I think that they should suspect that they'll have huge problems to deal with.
Mr. Hunter, Nigel's father, was one of many Indigenous men who joined the government spraying teams.
They should work from sun up to sundown for what pay they got, little knowing that they're going to die later on in later years.
What the men didn't know was the herbicides they were spraying from backpacks were the same chemicals used to make Agent Orange in the Vietnam War, 245T and 24D, which were contaminated with dangerous dioxins.
Poison was carried on the same vehicle as their water drums, and their swags and everything used to get soaked with the poison. They slept in it, worked in it for 10 days at a time. and all their clothes will get washed at home.
It wasn't an accidental spill on any workday. Their bodies were exposed to the herbicide all day, and I'm not talking about 8 hours in the day, but 24 hours a day, every week, for months and years. I can't conceive of anywhere where the exposure has been so intense and at such a level and for so long.
One of the workers, Carl Drysdale, said they would cart the drums of chemicals in the back of a four-wheel drive. The sprayers would go into the bush for 10 days at a time. For the first few years, the men were given no protective clothing.
Most of the people would be wearing what was appropriate for the heat, which would be shorts and thongs and T-shirts, you know.
A few years after spraying the chemicals, many of the men began to get sick.
Now, in the beginning, what were you told about the chemicals? How safe were they?
Harmless. So harmless you could drink it.
That's what they told you?
That's right.
Who told you that?
Oh, all the bosses, all the head shrinks.
But Carl Drysdale, who was the foreman, felt responsible for his men, and he was getting worried.
They all got rashes. Everybody got rashes, headaches, and I guess internal bleeding was another pretty universal thing, like they were vomiting blood and passing blood.
Carl wrote to his superiors in June 1982 about his concerns. A manager from the West Australian Agriculture Protection Board wrote back saying that 245T was not considered dangerous if used as recommended, and that he did not support staff undertaking their own research.
You're told that the stuff's harmless, so you think, well, you know, I'm probably wrong, so you give them the benefit of the doubt, you know? And that was a mistake to trust the government, you know?
The job was a perfect job for them, and they loved that kind of environment. Maybe if it had been a white person, they most probably would have stood up and said, well, I'm not spraying this, this doesn't smell nice, I'm getting a rash, I'm getting sores, I'm not touching this anymore. Well, if they wouldn't, they didn't want to lose their job.
After years of spraying, Mr. Hunter became so ill that he could no longer work and was often bedridden. He had sores all over his body, respiratory problems, dramatic weight loss, and extreme fatigue.
His black arms were dyed white or bleached white where that poison came in contact. He had great big lumps under his jaw from his glands, under his arms, and he told me in his groin. His general health was so bad that he couldn't get up the stairs at work to get his pay.
At 33, Mr. Hunter died in his sleep. He was the first of the Kimberley men to die, but others soon followed.
How many of those men are still alive?
Not very many, and if any, they're sick today.
Mainly headaches at the moment, yeah.
For more than 30 years, Carl Drysdale has been fighting to get workers' compensation for the surviving men.
Kept me awake all night last night.
When are you going to see
the doctor?
Carl himself has not been able to work since 1985 because of a range of illnesses he believes were linked to the spraying. His wife Marion has had to support him and their four children.
Carl has suffered from just about everything you can suffer from, and I've seen the physical decline in this powerful, energetic man since he finished with the APB.
I had like constant heart attacks, unconscious. They told my wife I was going to die over and over again. 5 black spots on my lungs. I've used cortisone cream for rashes that's ruined my bones.
Okay, I'm near this. Hold it level with your heart there.
Dr. Randolph Spargo was a local GP and saw many of the sprayers, including Carl Drysdale.
So it's definitely abnormal, Carl, but much better than it used to be.
Have you got any doubt all these years later that it was the chemicals that made a lot of these men sick and in some cases killed them?
No doubt about it. I wouldn't go near that herbicide.
The herbicides were contaminated with dangerous dioxins. Chemical Industries Kwinana in Perth imported some of these chemicals, which were supplied to the West Australian Agriculture Protection Board.
According to the normal toxicity...
In 1978, Four Corners reporter Andrew Olley interviewed the owner, the late Robert Telford.
But it's not a commercial problem.
What do you mean it's not a commercial problem?
It's because it's not possible for a person using commercial 245T containing these minute infinitesimal quantities of dioxin to be poisoned by them.
How do you know that?
The toxicity becomes meaningless in the dilution.
A few years later, Professor Ben Salinger, a former head of chemistry at the Australian National University, traced some of the chemicals to Singapore, where one batch had been fire-damaged.
The normal herbicide would have been light in colour and fairly fluid. The sample we had from the tariff board was clunky and black, so it would appear that there was a good chance they were using the stuff that we also looked at.
All of a sudden, at least 30, 44-gallon drums of concentrate arrived, and it was completely different to the stuff in the 20-litre drums. The stuff in the 20-litre drums was like engine oil and or honey, you know, colour. And the next lot came, it was black and thick, and it blocked up all the nozzles. And 30 drums was enough for at least 20 years.
Tests on a sample of the fire-damaged chemical later revealed it had 200 times the allowable level of dioxin then, and more than 2,000 times the levels permitted in later years.
Well, I think it would have been very dangerous. It was much higher than what was used in Vietnam. And at those levels, I think they were really exposed to a high level of risk.
The men continued to die.
They die with that sort of lingering question mark hanging over, why has this happened to me, you know? And to see that is terrible.
In 2001, occupational work specialist Dr. Andrew Harper was asked to investigate if the men's illnesses were linked to chemical exposure. Dr. Harper says the government's Agriculture Protection Board repeatedly failed in its duty of care.
One, they were not trained. Two, there wasn't an induction program. The information about the risk was not given to them. The supervision was not there. And they were not given, in the main, safety equipment. So they simply went out in shorts and shirts and thongs, and that was it. And there wasn't any systematic washing after exposure. So they were just completely exposed. And the authorities didn't take a responsible stand to, in fact, correct the situation.
Dr. Harper recommended all those who were sick be considered for compensation.
I recommended that compensation be considered, as I felt there had been a disservice done to all these people. And it wasn't only manifest in a specific illness, which was difficult to define. It was manifest through the way they were treated and through the impact that that had on their lives and on their feelings of alienation.
But the West Australian Labor government responded to Dr. Harper's recommendation by calling for another report.
Asking for a scientific study created a distraction from the content of my report.
That the men be compensated.
That the men be compensated. It diverted attention away from all of the injustices of the whole program. It diverted attention away from the suffering that these people had, and it diverted attention away from the moral issues that the whole thing exemplifies.
Former Agricultural Minister Kim Chance commissioned the new report.
Harper's report took us a long way because we began from a situation where we were trying to uncover the results of an event that occurred 20 years before. Harper's report allowed us to tie those events together. He said, look, it looks like there's a cause and effect issue here.
He was a lot stronger than that. He recommended that you consider compensation for all those men.
Yes.
He found a failure of duty of care by various governments.
Yes.
He found that there was no protective clothing, that these chemicals were suspected of being incredibly toxic and no training. Why did you need statistics to compensate the men when you had all that before you?
Because our means of compensation is the WorkSafe principles or the WorkCover principles. That's the only means we have of compensating a former government worker.
I'd like to get a jar of that poison and pour it down some of those politicians' mouth. Let them see how they feel about it.
The new report recommended only men with cancer be eligible for compensation. 10 years later, only 8 men have received workers' compensation.
To effect what Dr. Harper wanted us to do required a change in the law.
Well, why didn't you change the law?
Well, that's a matter for the whole of government to deal with. That's way beyond the authority of the Minister for Agriculture.
Dr. Randolph Spargo said the men were actually poisoned.
Yes, they were. They were. And they were told that the chemical that they were using couldn't possibly hurt them.
In fact, they were told it was so safe they could drink it.
They could drink it.
I mean, given all that, do you now, all these years later, find it hard to reconcile that they were never compensated, the great bulk of those men who got sick?
Yes.
If you could...
And indeed, I'll go further than that. I think Dr. Harper's recommendation was the right recommendation.
You're getting a rash on there too. There's all red on that side.
Despite this admission, nothing is likely to change for the children and partners of the sprayers, who believe they are now affected.
Slowly.
3 years ago, Nigel Sinclair was diagnosed with leiomyosarcoma, which is growing on a muscle at the back of his liver. Studies have linked soft tissue sarcoma with toxic exposure from Agent Orange, which was equal parts 245T and 24D.
Just battling to get up and walk around now. Just finding it hard to get out of bed and that, and had to get a new bed now, so... Yeah, and I'm more confined to a wheelchair. I put my shirt down now.
No mother wants to watch their son deteriorate like this, and it's something that can't fix, you know? Can't kiss it better, can't put a Band-Aid on it, and I've just got to watch him. And I don't like to. Got to try and keep strong.
More than 3 decades ago, when Sue Sinclair was pregnant with Nigel, she used to wash his father's chemical-drenched clothes. After Nigel was born, she would put his nappies in the wash with his father's work gear. And Nigel would crawl all over his father and his swag.
Horrible to think that I might have passed something on to my son. Now, I'd take that away from him any day and put it on myself.
If dioxin was present, the residual level of dioxin in the clothes need not be very high to be potentially harmful. And these chemicals have got the potential to damage genes and produce an adverse effect in the next generation. And this is a real concern.
Of the 77 workers Dr. Harper interviewed, 58% reported having fertility problems, stillbirths, and premature births. There were 12 reports of birth defects.
Some of the blokes have described what their children look like, and I won't even say what they've said about their own children, what they look like. And
why? What was
they look
wrong?
Like monsters, you know, like because of the deformities that they had.
Back in 1976, on the other side of the country, in the small rural town of Yarram in Victoria's Gippsland, a cluster of birth defects was found by a local GP. Dr. Rod Guy told Four Corners he believed the deformities might be linked to heavy spraying of 245T and 24D.
Well, we made a list of the abnormalities, the problems we'd had.
I'd had some really awful things happen, which were really unusual. A baby born without a brain, a baby born without kidneys. Now, in general practice, it's unusual to have serious birth defects.
The Victorian government held an inquiry in 1978.
The disappointing thing was that I thought that the inquiry was really very superficial and I think, to be honest, rushed to get a political answer.
The inquiry dismissed concerns that the chemicals were potentially dangerous and found that the cluster of birth defects in Yarram could have happened by chance. 2 years later, Professors Ben Salinger and Peter Hall found that there were serious statistical errors with that finding.
Well, Peter Hall is probably one of Australia's best statisticians, and he did that work and showed that the way they did their comparisons would have minimised anything showing up. And when he redid the work using their data, he showed a very high and strong correlation.
So in other words, they were saying that there wasn't a disproportionate number of birth abnormalities?
That's right, yeah. And his results showed that there were a very high proportion of birth abnormalities.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
First came the warning, then came the blast, shattering the Christmas morning silence in the heart of Nashville, Tennessee's tourist district. Before dawn on Friday, 25th of December, Nashville police officers rushed to calls of gunfire on 2nd Avenue. A strip of honky-tonks, restaurants and boot shops. Instead of gunfire, they found an RV, blaring a strange and unsettling message. There was a bomb. It would detonate in 15 minutes. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Jamie McKee, Rick Rojas, Lucy Tompkins, and Derek Bryson Taylor. The piece is titled, A Warning, Then a Blast. Nashville Explosion Was Deliberate, Police Say. First came the warning, then came the blast, shattering the Christmas morning silence in the heart of Nashville, Tennessee's tourist district. Before dawn on Friday, Nashville police officers rushed to calls of gunfire on 2nd Avenue, a strip of honky-tonks, restaurants and boot shops. Instead of gunfire, they found an RV, blaring a strange and unsettling message. There was a bomb. It would detonate in 15 minutes. When the RV did explode, it sent plumes of smoke billowing above the city, blew out windows in shops and offices for several blocks, left three people hospitalized, and the city of Nashville shaken. Police said the explosion was deliberate. It was also deeply unsettling, coming in an area that draws thousands of people nightly. But who set it off and why remained unknown, as officials began to make sense of the blast. The whole neighborhood shook, said Lily Hansen, who was sitting on her couch in her second-floor apartment in a loft building a few blocks away. She looked outside. I just can't get the image out of my head. The police released a photograph of the RV on Friday afternoon and said the vehicle had arrived on 2nd Avenue North at 1:22 a.m. local time. The RV was parked outside an AT&T transmission building, a separate building from the landmark 33-story AT&T office tower less than half a mile away. It is still unclear if a person was inside the RV when it exploded, officials said. In a news conference on Friday evening, police officials said there were no indications of fatalities, but possible human tissue had been found amid the debris. Gas lines were shut off in the area and AT&T experienced outages, which forced the Federal Aviation Administration, FAA, to temporarily halt flights out of Nashville International Airport. Nashville's mayor, John Cooper, said he saw extensive damage when he surveyed the area, including shattered windows and glass that had showered onto sidewalks, charred trees and water main breaks. At least 41 businesses have been materially damaged by the explosion, he said. Fire officials added that one building across from the explosion collapsed. Still, he acknowledged a measure of relief. Had the explosion taken place on a working day, he said, the outcome could have been far more dangerous. But he added later in the day that solace had shifted to resolving to find the perpetrators of this act and to rebuilding the area. This morning's attack on our community was intended to create chaos and fear in this season of peace and hope, Nashville Mayor John Cooper said. The FBI field office in Memphis, Tennessee, was taking the lead in the investigation, working with state and local enforcement agencies, as well as Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives. Acting Attorney General Jeff Rosen was briefed on the incident early this morning and directed all the Department of Justice resources be made available to assist in the investigation, a Justice Department spokesman said in a statement. Acting Attorney General Jeff Rosen became the Acting Attorney General on Wednesday after William Barr stepped down. Tennessee Governor Bill Lee said in a statement on Twitter that the state would supply any needed resources to determine what had happened and who was responsible. Bill Lee said he was praying for those who were injured and was thankful to the emergency workers. A spokesman for President Donald Trump said the president had been briefed on the explosion and was grateful for the incredible first responders and praying for those who were injured. The authorities said the explosion happened around 6:30 a.m. local time outside of 166 2nd Avenue North in a stretch of downtown with cafes, restaurants, barbecues, and bus stores. It is an area where the tourists who come to Nashville, Tennessee often flock to. But on Christmas morning, it was quiet. It's not a very populated area, Mr. Cooper said. After police officers arrived, they hurried to roust anyone they could find. The guests staying in nearby hotels, residents just waking up in the apartment buildings, people who had curled into the warmest crevices they could find as they slept on the street. A voice announced through a loudspeaker on the RV that a bomb would detonate and then began a countdown interspersed with music, the police said. A bomb squad was on its way, but it was too late. The RV exploded exactly as the recording had warned. Don Aaron, a spokesman for the Metropolitan Nashville Police Department, said the police officers' quick work in evacuating the area helped prevent the explosion from causing more harm. We think lives were saved by those officers doing just that, he said. On 2nd Avenue, just a block away from the Cumberland River, the blast left the roadway blackened with debris, including scorched trees and the hulls of vehicles destroyed by the explosion. Fire trucks and emergency vehicles were gathered at the edge of downtown, and blue lights flashed under the Hard Rock Cafe's large spinning guitar on Broadway. Except for a distant fire alarm and the sounds of a helicopter, downtown Nashville was quiet on Friday afternoon. The RV exploded just outside the Melting Pot, a fondue restaurant in downtown building, like many others in the area, that was erected in the late 19th century. Windows on either end of the building were blown out, as were the large, heavy doors at the building's entrance. The explosion also triggered the sprinkler system, which flooded the restaurants for about 8 hours. "It's a mess," said Mark Rosenthal, one of the restaurant's owners. "We have about 115 people working there, but that's 115 people that now don't have jobs, so that's rough to think about."
Around the World with Reporters.
The Palestinian Refugees Committee in the Gaza Strip organized a rally against the UN AIDS and Health Services reduction. Palestinian refugees who have impacted badly by this reduction participated in the demonstration, calling for the world body's attention to the dire condition in the impoverished enclave.
"It's our right to get the UN's aid services. People here are living in a deteriorating condition amid the pandemic. People here can't afford living, and now, with the reduction of the UN aid services, their life is getting even worse."
Palestinians believe the reduction in aid services by the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, is an attempt by the U.S. to liquidate the humanitarian organization. Earlier, the U.S. announced plans to withhold $65 million of aid to the UNRWA until further notice.
"The UN aid services reduction will have dire consequences as it deprives the Palestinian refugees from their basic rights. The reduction comes amid a critical political time as Israel is stepping up its pressure on the Palestinians.
By reducing the refugees' aid, the UN is standing beside the Israeli occupation at the expense of Palestinians' rights. We are calling for our rights, and the UN should fulfill its commitments."
The demonstrators call on the international community to reverse the reduction decision by the UN and keep on supporting the Palestinian refugees who have lost their lands and were expelled since 1948.
"The reduction policy aims at reducing the aid services step by step until Palestinians are completely deprived of their rights. The UNRWA was established to help and support Palestinian refugees. The reduction policies serve Israel's interests."
UNRWA was established to aid the 700,000 Palestinians who were expelled from their homes during the war surrounding Israeli occupation's establishment in 1948.
"More than the half of the 2 million people in the Gaza Strip are dependent on support from UNRWA, and depriving them from the services they need will worsen the living conditions." Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Some 12 million children are facing a nightmare in Yemen, where one child dies every 10 minutes from preventable disease and the lack of healthcare services due to the ongoing war and the blockade imposed by the Saudi coalition.
We are about to enter the 7th year since the start of the aggression against our country, which has greatly affected the humanitarian situation, especially for children, who are the most affected segment in all aspects of life, such as health, education, social, and other aspects. And they have lost all the rights guaranteed by international human rights law.
The numbers of affected children continue to grow each day. 2.1 million children are acutely malnourished and 358,000 severely malnourished, meaning that some children are already suffering under famine-like conditions. Meanwhile, Yemen's Ministry of Health held a press conference to shed more light on the dire conditions of children in the country.
What
the children of Yemen suffer as a result of the Saudi aggression and blockade since March 2015 is a real humanitarian catastrophe by all international standards. More than 2,400,000 children are deprived of education, and more than 3 million children are homeless. Malnutrition, which is spreading among children, has been condemned by international organizations and is said to be the result of not getting enough food.
Saudi Arabia has committed countless atrocities against children in Yemen, where children are also targeted by airstrikes. The air attacks have killed thousands of children and left thousands more suffering from disabilities, not to mention travel restrictions on thousands of patients, including children who need to travel for treatment.
As the world is silently watching an entire people being deprived of the basics of life, Yemen has become the most dangerous place in the world for children to grow up, according to UNICEF. Abdul Latif Al-Washari, Sana'a.
The Knesset, the Israeli parliament, dissolved itself and the unity cabinet collapsed, pushing the Israelis into yet another early election on 23rd of March that would be the fourth in 2 years. The Knesset dispersed after failing to meet the legal deadline for approving a budget for 2020. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of the conservative Likud party had refused to present a budget in violation of his coalition agreement with his main rival turned partner Benny Gantz of the centrist Blue and White party.
The dissolving of the Knesset was simply because of Netanyahu's unwillingness to give up the premiership. The very possible scenario is the return of another political impasse for Israel. So Netanyahu will not be able to form a coalition that's satisfying and acceptable for all parties. We may even witness a fifth election after the upcoming vote.
Experts, however, say the dissolving of the Knesset would have been more advantageous for Netanyahu. It's not only a deep distrust between Netanyahu and Gantz. Netanyahu was gambling on another election in the hope of forming a right-wing religious cabinet that would grant him some kind of immunity from prosecution. Netanyahu's corruption trial is scheduled to move into an intensive evidentiary stage in early 2021, requiring his regular presence in court. The current cabinet will remain in place in a caretaker capacity until after the election, and the formation of a new cabinet is a process that could take many months. However, the Israelis are convinced that there isn't any guarantee that the fourth election would finally end Israel's internal dogged stalemate. According to observers, Netanyahu has triggered early elections in an attempt to stay in power beyond his current term. However, they add that Netanyahu's fight for re-election is a difficult battle, mainly as his corruption trial is scheduled to resume with witness testimony next February. Mona Kandip, Occupy Ramallah.
Every year ahead of Christmas, this street in downtown Tehran gets packed with Christian residents in the capital, a rush to buy last-minute items to celebrate the birth of Jesus. This year, however, the hustle and bustle is gone, as the coronavirus pandemic has emptied the streets and pushed people into their homes. Many families cannot celebrate the festive season together. But Christians here say this does not mean they should abandon the celebrations when they can do it online.
Happy New Year and Merry Christmas to all. This year we miss all the family gatherings, but it's all right. We can catch up with each other using video calls. I hope that in the new year, the pandemic will be gone.
Merry Christmas to all Iran and all the world. And in spite of that, we have this pandemic time. I wish everybody will have very soon good times, and 2021 will be happy for every of us.
Nearly 120,000 Christians live in Iran. The majority of them are Armenians, who follow the Oriental Orthodox branch of Christianity. While they make up less than 1% of the Iranian population, they feel at home when it comes to Christmas.
You know, the Christmas.
Merry Christmas. It's good to see the Christmas atmosphere running deep here in Iran, where the majority are Muslims. We feel at home here.
Iran has for the past month been under nationwide lockdown to contain the resurging virus. This has curtailed religious ceremonies across the red zones in the country. And church rituals are no exception. While 2020 was not a happy year, Christians here say it taught humanity a great lesson, to value even the shortest moments with their loved ones. Now on this year's Christmas, Happy New Year is more than just a wish. And everyone is praying that in 2021, the coronavirus will be a thing of the past. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Karina was a working mom with a job in the tourism sector, decimated by the pandemic. With no savings to fall back on, and with her husband's delivery job earnings nowhere near enough for them to get by, they ended up in a position no one wants to find themselves.
I never knew about food bank. I just found out since I was on a financial difficulty.
Karina's quest for help led her to Educare Family Support Service, one of many publicly funded companies helping families down on their luck in the age of COVID.
We have lots of different food items that will go in. The plan behind it was that we would be able to prepare hampers for families, who disadvantaged families who may not be able to afford to have a Christmas meal or Boxing Day meal. So we've ensured that we've provided a hamper with everything excluding the meat. At the moment, we're on about 270. Literally, that is 270 families.
270 of many more families facing food insecurity and hunger, exacerbated by the pandemic, a situation that's drawn in UNICEF for the first time in its 70-year history in this country.
In these unprecedented times, I would imagine that these families have become known to their professionals that they're engaging with and are now require additional support.
This cavernous space is the interior of an Anglican church in West London. In normal times, it would see worshippers kneeling in prayer. Today, it's dedicated to something more pressing, getting food into people's cupboards.
I've got quite emotional, actually, about, you know, just the thought that you're privileged and get to enjoy Christmas and then other people are going without, especially at the moment with these troubled times. So I thought if I can come and make just a little bit of difference.
These hampers are being stuffed with supplies to last families for a few days. People used to go to food banks to pick them up. Since the onset of COVID, the whole project of compassion has taken on a new dimension, deliveries.
These volunteer drivers will be dropping off food and presents at hundreds of households for the next 3 days. A drop in the bucket considering the number of families depending on these supplies. And some of those families have up to 6 children.
Most of these volunteers found out about this project on social media. Some of them have dedicated their only day off to being here.
To see the family smiles and the people who need the things is, you know, I can't explain what you feel. The smile of them faces just can give me the energy. They can make my day.
Some have brought their young ones along so they can see firsthand what their less fortunate peers are going through. Those with bigger vehicles have come as couples to help transport more of this humanitarian assistance to homes where kitchen cabinets are not restocked as often as they should.
It's nothing for me to offer a couple of hours, so we are also in a position where it could be me who needs this support.
This year has been very contrasting in the fact that there's some people just getting richer and richer and richer, and we're reaching rock bottom, really, and in sense of community is getting destroyed, really.
If you're feeding a family of 4 to 6 people, that's going to last Yeah, 2 days. It will get them through till Christmas Eve, hopefully.
And we all think we're struggling. Karina has had to adapt to her new world, caring for her 3-year-old daughter in a small rented apartment with no garden while her husband works, and looking after her ailing father who lives on his own.
I know a lot of people are suffering during this difficult time. It's very challenging, but you have to be positive at all times. Seek for help. If you don't ask, you don't get it.
Karina is perhaps one of the tens of thousands of families, if not more, for whom survival depends on charitable donations. Saeed Puriza, London.
Christmas Eve 2020, Prime Minister Boris Johnson signed off on an historic post-Brexit trade and security agreement with the European Union after an intense 24-hour negotiation period. A press conference expected early in the day finally came in the afternoon after lawyers and translators had crossed all the T's and dotted all the I's.
I'm very pleased to tell you this afternoon that we have completed the biggest trade deal yet, worth £660 billion. A year, a comprehensive Canada-style free trade deal between the UK and the EU, a deal that will protect jobs across this country, a deal that will allow goods, UK goods and components to be sold without tariffs and without quotas in the EU market, a deal which will, if anything, allow our companies and our exporters to do even more business with our European friends.
A deal will mean Britain finally leaving the bloc's single market and customs union in a week, and freedom of movement will end. It also settles the future arrangements on a vast range of issues, from aviation and transport to civil nuclear cooperation and energy. The sticking point that took Brexit to the brink of no deal was access to British fishing waters, a contentious issue that prompted the UK to send Navy ships to the English Channel in case of clashes, and the level playing field, which is an important part of the EU single market, allowing for fair and open competition. The negotiations were very difficult, with lots at stake for many, and it was an agreement worth fighting for. Will allow us to avoid major disruptions to workers, businesses and travellers after January 1st. It will protect European interests, and this agreement is also, I believe, in the interests of the United Kingdom. It will lay solid foundations for a new start with long-time friends, and finally, it will ensure we can leave Brexit behind us. Europe continues to move forward. Despite the collective sighs of relief and resignation across Britain, the devil is in the detail. French media made waves in the hours leading up to it by asserting the UK had made huge concessions, something Westminster was quick to deny. Hardline Tory Brexiteers from the European Research Group have said its star chamber of lawyers will be convened to analyse the proposed agreement, suggesting it's not over yet. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Pakistan had a fresh round of negotiations with the UAE in an effort to repair lingering strained relations between the two countries. Pakistan has been under pressure from the UAE to normalize ties with the apartheid state of Israel since August this year, when Abu Dhabi recognized Tel Aviv. For the first time, Islamabad publicly admitted about the existence of a lingering UAE demand to Pakistan to grant diplomatic recognition to Israel. Something which Islamabad rejected after country's foreign minister's visit to Abu Dhabi.
I have abundantly made it clear to the UAE that Pakistan under no circumstances can establish diplomatic ties with Israel until a permanent and durable solution is found to the Palestinian issue. I have told them about anti-Israeli public sentiments in Pakistan and reminded them of the similar nature of dispute between Kashmir and Palestine.
Foreign Minister's visit to Abu Dhabi has followed suspension of visas to Pakistani citizens after alleged behind-the-scenes threats to Islamabad to replace its 1.5 million expatriates if Pakistan resisted pressure to normalize ties with the Tel Aviv.
Pakistan made its position clear
because of the mounting pressure from some of the Islamic countries. The problem for Pakistan is that at the public level, at the people level, it is very difficult to sell this idea of giving recognition to Israel, because for decades, Pakistani people have been steadfastly supporting the cause of the Palestinian people.
Despite close brother relations with the UAE, tens of thousands of people protested against Abu Dhabi after it normalized ties with the Tel Aviv. Israel has been desperate to normalize ties with Pakistan, hoping that if it happens, other Islamic countries would also follow the suit. However, observers say that Israel's effort through UAE and Saudi Arabia to create compelling conditions against Pakistan to normalize ties have fallen flat. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
The United Nations Security Council has held a virtual meeting to review the 10th report into the implementation of Resolution 2231, which endorses the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. During the session on Tuesday, Iran's permanent representative to the UN slammed the United States for not only failing to honor its own obligations under the resolution, but also obstructing the implementation of the commitments by other signatories. Takravanchi explained that in the past 4 years, the U.S. has imposed over 1,500 sanctions against Iran, targeting almost all sectors of Tehran's economy and cutting nearly all dividends from the nuclear agreement for Iran. He also referred to the humanitarian impacts of the sanctions on Iran, saying the embargoes are affecting the most vulnerable people in the country.
The United States claim that humanitarian goods are exempt from sanctions is an absolute lie. As an example, even today, we cannot easily import medicine for relieving the breathing problems of those injured by chemical weapons, which were provided by some Western countries to Saddam and used by him during his aggression against Iran.
The Iranian ambassador reiterated Tehran's stance that any proposal for the revision, renegotiation, or extension of the JCPOA is against the UN Resolution 2231 and absolutely unacceptable.
Iran has paid a heavy price and has done much more than its fair share to preserve the JCPOA. Therefore, no one can expect us to do more.
Takravanchi further said that the deal cannot be linked to anything outside of the nuclear program, such as Iran's missile capabilities.
To develop a conventional missile program is an inherent right of any country under international law, and Iran is no exception. Consequently, Iran will not negotiate its legitimate ballistic missile program.
The Security Council session came a day after foreign ministers of the remaining signatories to the JCPOA held a virtual meeting and reiterated their commitments to preserving the agreement. China and Russia in particular call on the U.S. to unconditionally return to the deal and lift its unilateral sanctions against Iran. This comes more than 3 weeks after the Iranian parliament passed a bill that requires the Iranian government to suspend more commitments under the nuclear deal in case sanctions continue. Iran started scaling back some of its commitments a year after the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the deal. Tehran has time and again rejected any preconditions for reviving the agreement, noting that it will go back to full compliance once all the other parties to the court uphold their own end of the deal.
General Qasem Soleimani was a high-ranking Iranian military official whose popularity began to rise after he led the war on Daesh terrorists on the battlefields in Syria and Iraq. General Qasem Soleimani was the commander of Iran's Quds Force, the foreign arm of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. He was of great help to Syria as an advisor and organizer of Syrian troops when Daesh and other Takfiri terrorists launched a bloody assault on Syria in 2011. He also played a key role in creating Iraq's Popular Mobilization Unit, also known as Hashd al-Shaabi, in 2014, when Daesh declared its caliphate in Iraq and overran several provinces there. Hashd al-Shaabi later managed to defeat Daesh and drive the terrorist group out of Iraq.
These victories for Syrian and Iraqi forces further increased General Soleimani's popularity among the Iraqis, Syrians, and Iranians. When General Soleimani declared the end of the Daesh Caliphate in 2018, the United States, which called itself the savior of the Iraqi and Syrian people, described him as its arch enemy and an obstacle to peace in the Middle East. The U.S. imposed sanctions on Soleimani. The Israeli regime also put Soleimani on its so-called terror list. In the year 2020, the assassination